Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that never outsources its content. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner of propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
This week, following the collapse of Carillion and news reports that other similar businesses like Capita may also be in danger of folding, we discuss the future of outsourcing and what a Labour government should do about it. Very briefly then, Steve, what was Carillion and why did it collapse and what's the problem?
Carillion is one of the major businesses which the government utilises as part of its outsourcing operation. So the government would essentially pay Carillion along with other companies such as G4S, Capita, to basically provide services to the public in some form. Some of those outsourced things will be really back-end systems like IT. A classic example of that in Birmingham, where Capita were providing IT support for Birmingham City Council.
And they do in other places like Barnet as well.
Yeah. For Carillion in particular, they were experts in construction. Basically, rather than having the government manage everything themselves, reaching out to contractors, bringing in all the different people and at the different stages of planning and development, you know, the government said to Carillion, you deal with all that. Carillion, however, had managed to get themselves into a bit of a tricky financial spot. Basically, the entirety of their business model is a Ponzi scheme based around constantly getting new money from the government. So what would happen is that Carillion would bid for a contract, a contract which in theory maybe was supposed to cost 10 million, just as an example figure, to fulfill over a 3 or 4 year period. They would bid 9 million because it costs less money. The government's policy is obligated to go with it. At which point, they end up in a position where they're like, hang on, we don't have the money to actually complete this. So what do we do about it? Well, we need to get some more money quickly. Well, there's more government projects. So we're going to take bid on more projects. And to guarantee them, we're going to underbid again. Take that money and use some of that money to fund the previous projects. And they keep doing that time and time and time and time again. And eventually, it all collapses like all Ponzi schemes do. For Carillion, their house of cards just got far too top heavy and they had no actual revenue really coming in to support all of the things that they were supposed to be working on. And as a result, the company collapsed.
And the reason that seems to have happened now is obviously the PFI boom started by John Major. And massively, massively expanded by New Labour. And obviously that's very, very controversial in the party. Also quite controversial because leads to hospitals taking on lots of debt. Often these hospitals are built with high rates of interest that hospitals now still having to pay off. And the reason why that's a problem now is because in the New Labour era, there was massive increases in spending, so there was lots of money for people like Carillion to bid on and play about with. Now, in a time of austerity, where the government is paying them less and less money, it's getting harder and harder for, as you say, to try and pay for A out of a pot for B and what have you, and that seems to have heralded their collapse.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is that if you look at the basically at the ecosystem of all of the various companies that all the various large companies which that central government tends to outsource to and local government tends to outsource to as well, such as Carillion and G4S and Capita, a very high number of them have all issued profit warnings in the past year. Capita issued another one this week. Serco had issued one less than a year ago, although they seem to have managed to turn themselves around. G4S have issued one, and yeah, it's all just a flawed business model. Which an awful lot of public services and are reliant on, and it's a very tricky and dangerous situation.
And in fact, there was a report from the National Audit Office a few weeks ago that said it was more expensive now for governments to borrow privately and use PFI for these contracts, more expensive to do that than it was just to fund and borrow the finance the projects themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So the PFI model is broken. Question is, what should be done and what could a Labour government do to try and improve the situation? Now, one thing that has been suggested is obviously, well, we contracted out to these private companies and that didn't work, so maybe we could just bring it all in-house and essentially we nationalise it all. What would be the problem with that?
So I think when you're talking about bringing back these outsourced functions back in-house to be run by the government, you need to kind of split this up into two different areas. There absolutely are a number of things which have been outsourced which do not need to be. It is entirely feasible, for instance, for the army to do its own recruitment. And it baffles me that currently, you know, that is outsourced in a number of ways.
The army's never used to do their own recruitment in the past.
No, it's clearly a radical thinking to get the army to do its own recruitment. So there's some areas like that should definitely be brought back in. You know, we've got classic examples of such as ATOS and their running of the various disability interviews for PIPs, which have been, shall we say, less than ideal. Those sorts of things should absolutely be brought back in-house. But what you can potentially do here is almost throw the baby out with the bathwater and just kind of say, no, we shall not outsource anything. And the reality is actually, the reason outsourcing exists in general is because it's a lot easier and a lot cheaper for most places, and because this is why it works in the private sector, and it does apply to the public sector as well, to work with a specialist in one area to handle certain things. IT is a classic example of this. Trying to have every single council, for instance, operate their own in-depth IT department, which can keep up with all of the latest trends, potential vulnerabilities, is just going to cost a fortune. Whilst, due to an economy of scale, you can work with an IT company who are doing it for all of their clients at the same time.
And there's examples like the NHS IT scandal where billions of pounds has been wasted that shows actually the government isn't really the best person to try and handle complicated projects like that, and especially IT projects.
Yeah.
I think the problem that the debate over outsourcing has and who should provide those services is pretty similar to a lot of the debate about nationalisation generally. And obviously a lot of Labour's flagship policies in the election, a lot of them are about nationalising things like the railways, bringing them back into control. And if we go back to what Tony Crosland said 60 years ago, and the whole point that he was trying to make is it doesn't necessarily matter if the state provides a service or a private company provides a service. What matters is the political culture around that. So if we look, for instance, at the post office as an example when it was run by the government, well, what happened was it was in public control. Any surplus money and the profit that the post office made, the Treasury just took and used it to spend on other stuff, didn't really invest in the infrastructure of the post office. Similar thing happened with the railways in the 80s. The government spends more on the railways after they privatised it rather than when it was nationalised, because essentially the government didn't bother investing in the railway structure. So nationalising isn't the be-all and end-all. What matters is that you actually do some planning, do some investment. Similarly, the problem I think with the Blair approach to outsourcing, they took Crosland's view that it doesn't matter who provides the service as long as the political culture is fine, and that ended up basically turning into what matters is what works, and that ossified basically into whatever Tony Blair thinks is common sense is what works. And then you end up giving people like ATOS lots of contracts when they're not treating people very nicely. You end up giving Carillion lots of contracts, despite the fact that Carillion, along with a lot of other of these companies that outsource, they blacklisted people who are on trade union lists. They would not hire people because they were in a trade union. Now, there is no way that any government, but particularly a social democratic government with democratic socialist values, should be outsourcing any work to any company like that. And so I think a lot of it is a bit of a red herring, like the nationalisation debate. It's about trying to change the culture about outsourcing so that it works.
Yeah, and I think that point about culture is the important thing here, because I think in both the case of government-run services and also these outsourced services from in terms of things like Carillion, Serco and the like. The problem is the overall internal culture that they operate in. So you utilised the example earlier of the post office where, you know, the treasury would come in, take the dividends of the business and go and spend it elsewhere rather than investing in the actual infrastructure for the post office. And you can see similar things almost happening with Serco, where, as you say, the only difference is it goes to their shareholders rather than on into the infrastructure for, say, the NHS. It's a very flawed business mindset, and business mindset, I think, is the right term to use, because if you're going to run public services, to a degree, they have to be run like a business, because the post office is a business. It has people that it needs to pay. It has a service that it needs to deliver. It's got pension liabilities that it needs to keep up with. It needs to be able to perform all of the basic things that every business needs to do. And as a result, you need to treat it like a business, which means taking away the profits from the post office to spend on something else, or taking away its profits to give to shareholders, neither of those things necessarily work when you've got a baseline service which everybody is reliant on. And that's what needs to change if you're going to kind of bring more things in-house, is making sure that things that are run, and again, this is the case with British Rail previously, is that they are treated like a business which can make investments in its own like infrastructure and its own long-term health.
I think there's an element to that, but I think with the post office and railways, there's also ways in which we need to think about the nature of the public sector and the public space, and the way in which actually they are also public sector organisations that provide a public good as well as being a business. For instance, in the post office, you have to deliver occasional letters to communities that are out of the way, that it's not profitable to deliver letter, you know, one letter to a cottage in the middle of nowhere, or it's not profitable to have a rural train line that goes very that not many people use and might not be very profitable. I know it's not quite the point you're making, but the point, the reason why you can't just say get a private business to run it, to run a railway like a business, in the same way that we allow Tesco, say, to run a supermarket like a business, is because there are things that that company does that will inevitably not be profitable, and they need to be done for the public good.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree 100% with that. And I think actually that is, as you say, the issue you have with outsourcing on and to a degree privatisation in some forms, particularly around, say, you know, train travel, bus services and things like that. The reality is the government still has to subsidise those services to ensure that that public good, you know, those rural country routes, for instance, for buses, are actually there in some form. Otherwise, you know, the business sense does say, well, nobody's going to use it other than these five people, so why should we bother keeping it up? It's you know, it doesn't actually make us any money. But given where we are currently, I think actually the biggest challenge that needs to be overcome is the notion that public services need to be able to stand on their own two feet as a business within their market. Because that's actually how, if you look at all of the places which do have, you know, strong government involvement in various sectors, so places like South Korea, they do it by treating them like any other business. Yes, they may have some more public sector elements in there, such as maybe a bit more subsidies to help cover these things, but they are still focused on that notion of long-term development rather than short-term gain. And that's something which is a massive issue across the entirety of the British economy, is that focus on short-term, quarterly by quarterly results. Mm. And I think that's something which politicians of any political hue will be very tempted to kind of fall back on, is that short-termism, where it will be, what will get me the most votes at the next election that's coming up? What policy is going to make me more popular, rather than what policy is going to actually deliver the level of public service in a sustainable way for the majority of the population that are going to use this service?
I think that's a problem that the Attlee government ran into, I almost feel like a heretic now criticising Clement Attlee. I feel like I'm going to be burnt to the stake at the next CLP meeting or something. But a lot of the problem with the nationalisations that happened under the Attlee government is the structures stay the same. Often the management stayed the same. The way the business ran stayed the same. What changed was just the name on the door, really, or the branding. What didn't really happen was the planning. That actually, you look at a lot of the other social democracies in the 50s and 60s, places like France, places like Italy, places like Germany. What happened was there was a good deal of planning and a good deal of cooperation. And certainly in Scandinavia and Germany, there's a lot of cooperation between governments and business in a way that didn't really happen in Britain. There was a lot of nationalising and bringing it into public ownership, not then a lot of planning or long-term thinking. I think what's interesting is, actually, I think because of Corbyn's past history, because of his past politics, there's an interesting kind of you need Nixon to go to China type logic to a lot of the things that Labour might be able to do on thinking about state ownership generally. So Angela Rayner, who's Shadow Education Secretary, someone we've praised on the podcast, she's made some interesting comments and interviews about the National Education Service. And she's come out and she said, well, I don't really want to talk about structures. I don't want to talk about who's running a school. What I want to think about is we need more safeguards for parents. You know, parents don't really care about who's running a school, whether it's an academy or a free school or what have you. What matters is what safeguards have parents got against, say, an academy chain just up in sticks and going, like happened in Wakefield is the example that she gave. And that's really, really interesting, and a really interesting shift, because I remember back in the glory days when it looked like Liz Kendall might be Labour leader, I remember going to her speaking in a pub in Birmingham, and she was getting a lot of abuse, a lot of contempt from, you know, those on the left of the party who didn't like her position on free schools. And Liz Kendall's position on free schools is pretty much the same as the Angela Rayner position, which is, well, Labour's going to be in government in 2020, there's not, so therefore these schools would have been in place for 5 years. We need to think of a way to make them work. And if they're working and popular with parents, why would we get rid of them? And it's interesting that on education, there is that more nuanced thinking on school structures in a way that you need to, because of the amount of schools that are run as an academy. It's particularly, I think, particularly secondary schools, that's the case. And it'd be interesting to see if similar things happen in terms of outsourcing.
Well, you are beginning to see some of some interesting kind of ideas emerging. So I think it's Preston Council have implemented a new outsourcing policy, which is, basically a Preston first, or, you know, make Preston great again, however you want to term it.
Yeah, you need to have a talk with our marketing department.
Yeah, clearly. But the long and short of it is their idea is to source locally. So if they need an IT provider, they will go to the most appropriate IT provider in their region, ideally within their actual council area, but in practice it's probably just maybe a bit wider than that. If they need to get something built, they'll try and find a contractor to do it in their area, with the idea being that if all of the money is being spent by local government, it's then at least going into businesses in their region and being trickling down into the local businesses and the local economy, which is a very nice way, I think, of almost, I don't want to call it a compromise position between the two extremes, but it seems to be a much more kind of focused, realistic, and practical way of handling outsourcing. Yes, there are a number of things which can probably be brought in-house still, but for those things that do need to be outsourced, or, you know, there's significant benefit in outsourcing them, actually trying to make it so that it's local specialists that are seeing the benefit rather than a giant corporation such as Carillion or Serco or G4S or Capita, it makes a lot of sense, not just in terms of, you know, what should a left-wing Labour government or whatever do, but in terms of delivering meaningful growth and development for local economies as well.
It's certainly an area in which you could get a consensus between Labour and the Conservatives. Certainly if you compare Preston with the other Labour council, which is getting a lot of publicity for its outsourcing approach, and that's Haringey. But Haringey Council have a local development vehicle, in which essentially what happened was that all of the services in Haringey of housing and libraries and what have you, they're put into this kind of £2 billion local development vehicle, in which I believe it's Lendlease, I think a private company, essentially uses it. And that's been very, very controversial in Haringey and has led to a lot of councillors being deselected. And the reason why Haringey has been in the news is because it's being used by a lot of the media as being an example of where Momentum are targeting councillors and deselecting them.
Yeah, so there is an awful lot of focus on Haringey. Now, I think there's two things to focus on here. One is the actual policy of the Haringey development vehicle itself, and the other is the media fracas around the kind of the moderate versus Corbynite battle, which is supposedly going on there. The important thing to talk about is the policy itself. The thing that actually doesn't really matter is that media bubble of Corbynites versus moderates, because it's not really about that, and it's only really being given the attention nationally as a policy because of that, because the media is seeing it as this nice little microcosm of what might be happening somewhere else in Britain.
Spoiler alert, it's not happening.
No, it's not happening anywhere. And if these sorts of things do happen moving forward, it will be as a result of policy choices that local councils or local Labour councils make, which go against the grain of Labour Party members' beliefs. And the Haringey development vehicle is a classic example of that. It's basically supposed to deliver, you know, improved housing and things like that, but it doesn't necessarily deliver on social housing, as an example. You know, you are literally uprooting families to put them somewhere else, rather than in the communities that that they live in currently, with no real plan as to how they're actually going to see their lots improved. And that's really where the focus should be when we talk about Haringey. What can we learn from its failures as a policy to actually roll out elsewhere? And what's interesting is that Corbyn and his leadership team's reaction to this has been to start talking about a policy which is all about kind of giving residents a say on development programmes. And you can kind of see where that comes from. It's a nice way to be inclusive, to give people a voice. It's very democratic. And, you know, it's not necessarily a bad policy at all. You know, I could see it potentially it being abused in some instances, maybe. But let's, you know, I'm not going to pick at it too much right now. But you can go a bit further with how you can learn from this. So, for instance, if you are a council of any sort and you are doing a regeneration scheme, any scheme should include social housing as part of it. Because, actually, if you want to have a healthy social housing sector, one, you need to build more houses in any form, basically. But two, you can't just have it so like where we have the situation currently, where you just have, you know, council estates and things like that, where they become no-go areas for people. They end up more deprived, you know, less money is thrown at them and for various reasons. If you make every development have to have a degree of social housing in there, so you can then basically say, okay, 10% of all of the housing that gets built over here has to be social housing, then you're able to put people together and actually put people in social who are in social housing in different communities, rather than just segmenting them off as though they're some kind of, you know, putting them in almost in a ghetto at points. And that's not an exaggeration when you do look at some of the social housing areas that do exist in Britain.
No, and the response to Haringey is very interesting, and a lot of it has been a lot of people who are frustrated. A Labour council should use any method to try and improve the lives of people, and somehow the fact that there's opposition to this proves that they're not able to be flexible and develop flexible policy, which, I mean, as we've said repeatedly already on the podcast, it's about trying to find things that fit your values, and if it doesn't fit your values, then you shouldn't do it. I do still have an issue with the Labour NEC then telling a Labour council what they should do, and I think there were 70 council leaders, including Birmingham Council, where we're based. They sent a letter, I think, to The Guardian, saying that the Labour NEC shouldn't be interfering with the Labour Council. But I don't think it's inconsistent to say that local development vehicle is not a good policy, but also that the Labour NEC should not comment on it. I don't see a contradiction there.
I'm very much in agreement with all of those council leaders that sent that letter. Like, the NEC, the Labour National Executive, should not have been involved with this. It is a local decision made by the local council, and you know what? You know, consequences have happened as a result of those actions. A number of them have been deselected by their local Labour parties because of their support for that vehicle. That's how it should be. Like, you don't need to get Labour's leadership involved in that sort of stuff. And I think that is also one of the areas where I think there is a danger for Labour, especially when we start talking about outsourcing, because taking those sorts of issues up to that kind of level within the Labour leadership hierarchy sets a bit of a precedent that those things fall within that remit.
Hmm.
And it's one thing to do it with something that's making news, albeit for all the wrong reasons, but it does set the precedent that maybe you could do it for other things. To take an example from Birmingham, the bin strike, which happened, you could easily have made a point that that the NEC should have stepped in on that as well. And at that point, you know, it's Labour. You know, they're going to be very, very, open to working and talking to the unions on that side, which could then put pressure on the local council to act in a certain way, which may or may not end up being the wrong decision for the actual council itself and for the services in that region. So there is a massive danger that Labour could start Labour leadership could start poking their head into things where then they shouldn't be, which could be massively bad in terms of how services get run within local areas.
Yeah, and that's not how we make policy in the Labour Party. That is not the role of the NEC. Talk about it at a conference if you want to, but the NEC is not the place for that. Maybe just quickly finish off with some of the things maybe that a Labour government could do. So Stella Creasy has called for a windfall tax on PFI companies and this kind of thing, which is a way of trying to claw back some of the some of the money that is being paid because of those exorbitant rates of interest. And that is something I think that kind of one-off reminds me very much of Ed Balls' banker bonus tax. Do you remember that?
The thing that got spent about 12 times.
Yeah, every policy that Ed Miliband had would be funded by a bank bonus tax. But John Trickett, who is, I think he was part of the manifesto making this time round, and he's part of the inner circle, I think, with Corbyn at the moment. Well, he wrote some stuff for the Fabians when he was, I think, Communities Shadow Minister under Ed Miliband. And he was saying that Labour should lay down some guidelines that companies should follow if they're going to get government contracts. One of them is that they provide decent training to their staff. One of them is that they should give their staff a living wage. And the other is that those companies should be subject to freedom of information requests. I don't see a problem with any of that. And it's interesting that when Ed tried to make that an issue in the 2015 election campaign, he wasn't really able to because the Tory press and the right-wing press were able to say, and let's face it quite rightly, well, hang on, Ed, you were part of a government that massively increased PFI. Now you're whinging about all of these payments and all of these things. What the hell are you going on about? Whereas actually, Corbyn's in quite a nice position where he's able to say, well, I opposed all of that. He's able to come out and say, and almost do it differently. His supporters will probably be able to back him with whatever policy he comes up with. But he's also not able to be attacked from the point of view of hypocrisy on this in the way that Ed was.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from that perspective, Labour is very lucky actually to have Corbyn as leader currently, because any of the other potential candidates that we've been looking at through the various challenges, I think maybe other than Owen Smith, had all been serving in government and been responsible for these PFI deals in some capacity. So, yeah, guess what? You know, if Yvette Cooper was a leader right now, wouldn't be able to make this line of attack. Corbyn can, and Corbyn can actually, hopefully, if he's sensible and careful, change the culture within the government on these sorts of things moving forward, so that we have a much better, much more reasonable and much more effective outsourcing policy.
We are going to end on a note of optimism about Jeremy Corbyn's leadership.
For once.
Truly, truly, it has been a crazy couple of years that this podcast has been recording. That's it for this week. If you want to read more about what we think, Then you can see our website, notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. And our Twitter page is controversially @nochampagnepod. My personal Twitter handle is @paperbackwriter.
And I'm @centerradical.
James Cram designed our logo, and Dave Depper is responsible for our theme tune, Cookie Good Times. Happy plotting, everyone.